Okay, well, we'll continue along with our program then. And next up, we have Pedro Sanchez and Patrick Maturo to talk to us about tropical soils research.
Thank you, Eric. I follow the rules, ask for a younger soil scientist colleague who was not my graduate student, but we have worked together for a while. Anyway, I'm going to try to get at the concepts that have evolved in tropical soils research rather than individuals or anything else, but just the concepts. Interestingly, that as you would expect, most of them, it takes a while to get these new concepts in. Many of them were ideas published in one paper 10, 20 years before, and then all of a sudden it became important. Many of them came from the temperate region. Many of them came from the tropics. So I'll do the first part, which is the backward look, and Patrick will do the forward look. When SSA was born, tropical soils were considered unique. One thing, the red, acid, and fertile, low in organic matter, and when you clear the forest off, they would turn irreversibly into laterite. Up to about 1970s, this was the main view. And of course, they were useless for agriculture also, if that happens. Well, you have a piece of laterite there. Laterites is a rock outcrop, basically, ironstone rock outcrop. In this case, what the local people do is they use it for bricks. And this is a rock outcrop in Kenya that's been used to build a building. And Angkor Wat in Cambodia was built the same way. And laterites occupy maybe 7% of the aerial tropics. And we have laterites in Wisconsin. We have laterites in Germany. And we have plenty of laterites in North Carolina as well. So it's not necessarily a tropical thing, but just simply an accumulation of iron that becomes a rock outcrops. Well, that's the way tropical soils were seen by basically temperate region scientists there at that time. Now we know that tropical soils are diverse, and all I want to put here in this bunch of numbers is to specify that that both the tropics and the temperate zone, all 13 soil orders of soil taxonomy are there. The jelly soils are in both places, and certainly in the tropical regions, just on top of some mountains. But the point is that there's a great variability on soils in the tropics as well as there are in the temperate regions. But we do have stereotypes. And the stereotypes in the tropics is this oxysol from Brazil. And the stereotype in the temperate region is this molasol from Iowa. Although those of us who studied in southern United States don't quite appreciate that. As a matter of fact, we feel that our soils, all the soils in North Carolina, southeastern United States, are a little bit closer to the tropical ones than this stuff up north here. Interesting. Both orders have similar soil organic matter contents, although that doesn't look it. But if you analyze it, that's it. And interestingly now, both of soil orders are producing the same yields in a comparable crop, which is soybeans. Soybeans in Brazil, primarily under oxysols, are yielding average yields, the last 5 years, 2.6 tons per hectare. Soybeans in the U.S. during that same time period have averaged 2.8 tons per hectare. And one year Brazil is ahead, the other one behind, and so on and so on. So this tropical soils useless for agriculture are doing just as well when agronomists learn how to manage them as opposed to the earlier views. Their difference is not in processes of chemical, physical, biological processes. The difference are in the degree of expression of those processes. And a very important one is the concept of variable charge clays as opposed to permanent charge clays. in which one of the best people who really clarified this were from Hawaii, particularly Goro Yuhara. And and variable charge clays are those that have a chemistry very, very different. It's just like Mike Vipraska talking about hydric soils and upland soils. Very, very different. While the permanent charge clays are also very, very different. But as you see below, hope you can read down here, variable clays occupy 60% of the tropics, but the other 40% has either mixed mineralogy of the two or purely permanent charge clays, just like you would find in the temperate region. Now, if you look at the temperate and boreal regions, only 10% of the soils have variable clays, and the rest is either mixed or temperate. So, yeah, there are more of those in the tropics than in the temperate regions, but they occur in both places. In the tropics, a practical way to tell this is just to drive a Land Cruiser over them, and you will feel the difference. You don't need an X-ray machine for that. Okay, so we work, basically we, and it's a very strange we, people involved in tropical soils. Up to the 80s, they dealt with what I call the first soil fertility paradigm. Overcome soil constraints through the application of fertilizers, soil amendments, irrigation to meet whatever the crop requires. This is very much drawn from temperate region agriculture. And in that sense, there were many breakthroughs, some of them instigated by people, again, not living in the tropics, but working in the tropics, and other ones, many, many ways. So success is many factors. The main one is the aluminum was identified as a major cause of soil acidity, leading to liming to pH 5.5, as opposed to pH 7.0 or something like that in Midwestern United States with permanent charge clover soils. Brazilians and South African scientists, and some scientists stationed in Georgia and North Carolina as well, ameliorated subsoil acidity by adding gypsum, which expanded the root volume of crops and decreased drought stress. And this is, we're talking millions of dollars here. Figure out a way to alleviate phosphorus deficiency, extreme phosphorus deficiency in soils with high P fixation capacity. Realistic methods of determining effective cation exchange capacity and base saturation that makes sense for variable charge soils. And certainly the widespread use of specific rhizobium strains for soybeans. Mainly soybeans. Also, a vastly improved database on geographical distribution of soils, their classification according to quantitative criteria. We owe this to soil taxonomy, where every syllable, whether we like the terminology, every syllable is quantified. And boy, did that ever help me. I'm a soil fertility person. Did that ever help me? And then the interpretation of things like soil taxonomy as fertility constraints on a realistic basis, the fertility capability classification system, and effective semi-automated soil testing methods. This first paradigm was the king in the 70s, up to the 70s. Then the second paradigm came when agronomists and ecologists got together for the first time. And it was just like meeting a monster in the middle of the night. I was one of the token agronomists in one of these initial meetings of the Tropical Soil Biology and Fertility Program, which you belong to now, I did too, and many other people here. But we look at rely more on biological processes to optimize nutrient cycling, minimize external inputs, and maximize efficiency of their use. That gave rise to germplasm selection for aluminum, low P and low zinc tolerance. Again, the original idea came from Beltsville, Maryland, and Charlie Foy. Low input soil nutrient management, organic input quality. I think the first idea came from Cheryl Palm in Peru. Conservation tillage, which comes from Kentucky, but applied to the to the tropics. And deep captures of nutrients leached from the topsoils by trees. And this is agroforestry, very much tropical. leguminous fallows and cover crops, biological terraces and filter crops, combining organics and inorganic inputs, part of the organic debates. Nutrient depletion then was identified as a major cause for declining crop yields in tropical Africa, and something I put there in Portuguese, integração lavoura pecuária, integration of crops and pastures. And I'll quickly say that the crops, everything is plowed deeply, and you add lime, phosphorus, gypsum, even silicates. And that's the last time you plow deeply in the soil. Then animals are put in, and they improve the biological properties of the soils, and they go back and forth, but with no tillage in the other crops. Now, I'll leave the third paradigm and the future to my colleague, Dr. Patrick Mutua.
Thank you very much, Pedro, and for introducing that. Moving on to the third paradigm and some of the aspects for the future work and, of course, what is happening presently. The integrated soil fertility management, as a continuation of what just Pedro has presented, is that it came along that, of course, mixing organic inputs together with fertilizers is still not sufficient. You need to add on something else, and that is about the knowledge to adapt this to local conditions, and again, the use of improved germplasm. So it is that combination that makes the integrated soil fertility management concept. These practices necessarily include appropriate fertilizer organic input management in combination with utilization of improved germplasm. And that is in the next slide. Now, this is where I would like to describe the concept much more diagrammatically. One is that in what we call responsive soils, I'll talk about each of them separately, is that when you talk about current practice, you're talking about, mostly in the tropics, like in Africa, in Asia, where there is no use of fertilizer, local seeds and such. The nitrogen recovery will be low. You put in fertilizer and improved germplasm, you will get good responses. Especially in responsive soils. When you add organic inputs onto that mix, you get improvement in recovery. And then now, the last thing is to incorporate the local adaptation. You do local adaptation. Okay, now, on responsive soils, poor, less responsive soil, what are we talking about? We are talking about soils that are poor in soil organic matter and of poor physical properties, soil properties, like aggregation, sandy soils and such. So actually the difference mainly occurs in the use of organic inputs, because these ones are the ones which prove to be very significant in non-responsive soils, unlike in the responsive soils where fertilizers seem to do much more magic. So generally that now presents the third paradigm, the soil fertility, integrated soil fertility management. Now we have some transformative methods recently developed in the last 10 to 15 years. And this is like the use of near-infrared spectroscopy in soil analysis. This method has now become common practice, I would say, in the tropics, whereby now, you scan the soil through 500 to 250 nanometer wavelength, and you get the regression coefficients, and then now you are able to pick up those signal areas and correlate them with soil properties. Of course, this one, for you to do this, you still have to do some wet chemistry. But once you have developed the database, then you would not need to go back there. So currently this practice is being used for developing the first African digital soil map, and I think now at this time we are getting of age as Africa to the US. I think this is the time we are talking about digital soil map in the US, and we are talking about the same you know, in Africa. And I think we are a bit ahead on this one alone. some of the examples of the predictions using that methodology of NIR is that we are able to predict soil carbon pretty well, nitrogen pretty well. I couldn't put all the figures there for every other thing, but mineralogy, texture, and metallic elements are also very well predicted using the NIR. We still have a problem with calibrating phosphorus using this methodology, but hopefully very soon we'll get better prediction with some work. Some other processes are being still characterized very well using the spectroscopy, the NIR spectroscopy. And this is like the carbon mineralization from organic materials, as well as carbon mineralization from mineral soils. And again, the organic input quality. You know, Pedro has just mentioned about organic input quality. And we have tried to do the same, you know, scan these organic inputs, manure, you know, leaves and twigs of or varying quality, and apparently we can just use this technology in quick assessment, and the predictions are pretty well. Now we go to now what is going to be a complex issue as far as moving forward, and this is climate change and African agriculture. Of course, there is high dependency on rain-fed agriculture in the tropics, and especially in the rural areas. And this makes Africa very vulnerable, of course, geographically, where it is situated, apart from the geographical, the traditional practices. And this one now puts like kind of a multiple stress situation. And now we need to move forward to look at how to adapt and to this situation. So the rain-fed yields might go down by 50% in some countries in the next, say, 20 years, whereby there is situations of increased water stress, and especially in the semi-arid areas. Okay, now, how to adapt? These are these are more general things, things that you might be knowing. We need to intensify food production, and this is using improved access to inputs. Shifts in crop and varietal selection towards greater drought tolerance and disease tolerance. Improved storage. This will be very important because the harvest losses, in fact, in some of our African countries, we have done a study in Malawi, Kenya, Tanzania recently, and harvest losses can go as high as 39%. And so for us to achieve food security, we have to look at such kind of things. We also need to diversify our cropping systems so that we can be able to, make the agriculture, as a business for the African farmers. Water harvesting is very important because with the water getting scarce, then we have to make better use of it. And then we have to talk about weather insurance and crop insurance, some of the things that are happening elsewhere, but we need to adopt them in the tropical situations. In terms of mitigation approaches, I'm talking of mainly the areas which I've circled red there, that we are talking about, afforestation and reforestation. And some of the details in there is that we need to work on the species that can adapt. Nutrient management will be very important so that we can be able to make good use of our nitrogen, phosphorus, and other nutrients that we add into the soil. And then agroforestry. These ones will be good practices on the part of afforestation and reforestation. In terms of non-forest kind of practices, we have no-tillage practices, improved pastures, balanced plant nutrition, and such. So we need to embrace some of these practices into our future work as we try to work towards working against the climate change effects. Then with the Africa now moving into a green revolution, we need to use models. One of the speakers who had spoken earlier talked about the use of models. In Africa and most of the tropical areas, models have not been widely used. So this is an area where we need to move into. And use of technology savvy analytical methods. That is in addition to the NIR spectroscopy, the use of thermal analysis of soils and such. We need to move into those kind of methods. And then we also need to exploit opportunities for adaptation and mitigation, the ones that I've just said. And of course, without climate change, we need an African Green Revolution. And with the climate change, we need it yesterday, or we need it urgently, and it is starting to happen. And now, this is just the last slide showing you how we need to move forward with SMS agronomy and other technologies. Thank you so much.